are listening to Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. Call it what you want, a social revolution, a massive popular mobilization, a radical transformation of society. It all happened in Spain for a few exhilarating years in the 1930s. In the midst of the brutal Spanish Civil War, anarchists and their allies recreated their own world, taking over factories, expropriating land, setting up collectives, leading lives divorced in significant ways from the status quo. The 1936 rebellion against the Spanish Republic by four generals, including Francisco Franco, marked, according to my guest today, the effective collapse of official government power. And in many ways and many places, anarchists stepped into the breach, maintained order, and experimented with egalitarian, non-hierarchical ways of doing things. Those committed anarchists included women, some of whom decided to create a separate organization called Mujeres Libres, and in the process pushed both anarchist theory and practice in new directions. Martha Acklesberg has written a book about both the anarchist revolution and Mujeres Libres. It's entitled Free Women of Spain, Anarchism and the Struggle for the Emancipation of Women. Martha Acklesberg is a professor of government and women's studies at Smith College. She joins us now by phone from her home in Massachusetts. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Let's begin by defining anarchism. I know this is not an easy task, but you do offer in your book a number of statements about anarchism, including this one. Anarchism aims to abolish hierarchy and structured relations of domination and subordination in society. Elaborate on that for us.
Okay. From the anarchist point of view, actually many sociologists say the same thing, societies are structured by hierarchical relations. I suppose the ones that we're most aware of are the ones Marx talked about, relations of class. We also are aware of relations of domination and subordination based on gender, based on race. And what the anarchists talked about was the way those kinds of relationships are institutionalized in structures of society, and paralleled, they included things like the church and the state, where anarchists differed, for example, from the socialists was Marx and his followers thought that once you had eliminated relations of domination and subordination based on class, based on capital, all other kinds of hierarchical relationships would kind of fall by the wayside, that it was economics that held them all up. And the anarchists saw each of these different things, political power, economic power, power based on gender, power based on religion, working in relation with each other, but also to some extent independently. So they looked at all of them, and they argued that if we're going to be truly free and able to realize ourselves as individuals in society, we have to get rid of all structured relations of domination and subordination, all formally structured authority relations.
And if government is a formally structured relationship of domination and subordination, then in what way would an anarchist society want or hope to govern itself?
Well, what they advocated and envisioned was basically a series of federated collectives. They thought people could organize themselves on the basis of voluntary organizations, the kinds of things that we saw in this country in the 60s and in the feminist movement, things like workers' cooperatives, healthcare collectives, free schools, that sort of thing. Their image was that it would be based in substantial part on unions that had been organizing, certainly in Spain, for many years before the Civil War, that workers, through their work in unions, would have learned really how to organize factories so they could run the factories on their own without management, and that you would then have collectives, federations, representatives from different unions, different community-based organizations would meet to make decisions for let's say, for the whole community or neighborhood, and then you'd have federations of neighborhoods that would meet to make decisions for a city, and ultimately these things would federate regionally and, in the case of Spain, nationally. So that was, for example, how all the anarchist and libertarian organizations in Spain were structured. They had local organizations, and then they would send representatives on up to the next level. And that's what they imagined organizing the society as a whole.
There is an idea called mutuality or mutual aid that anarchists and the Spanish anarchists adhere to. And I wondered if you could talk about that in relation to maybe the critique of hierarchy and what formalized, what institutionalized hierarchy does to people, both the subordinated people in any hierarchy and the people at the top.
Right, good. The notion of mutual aid really comes from Kropotkin, who was a Russian geographer, social geographer and anarchist, and who, looking at the animal world, actually, came up with the idea that what makes it tick, what makes it function, is not what Darwin said, survival of the fittest, in the sense of everybody in competition with everyone else, but in fact, mutual aid. That there may be competition between species, but within species, what enables groups and individuals, in fact, to survive is working together with others. And he advocated bringing that insight, really, into social relationships. So one of the key principles of anarchism, building on this idea of mutual aid, is we often associate anarchism with freedom, with individualism, with individuality, but they insisted that a person can develop him or herself fully only in collaboration, in cooperation with others. We need other people, and other people need us. We exist in society. So that the basic orientation really is one of cooperation rather than one of competition. Now, to get back to the question you asked about government and structured relations of domination and subordination, what they pointed out was that any group that's in a position of power maintains power over the subordinated by basically disallowing those in the subordinate position to make decisions about their own lives, and by perpetuating the myth that the subordinated are incompetent and incapable. So, from the anarchist point of view, we have governments, and governments tell us that we need them in order to survive, that if we didn't have government, we would all be at each other's throats, like, let's say, what's going on in Iraq. But in fact, they're saying the government and formal relations of authority that disempower people, in fact, create the conditions for their own existence. That if we were left to our own devices, we would find ways to cooperate, and we could do that much more easily without these former formal structures of authority than we can, that we're, in a sense, having to fight them all the time in order to recognize our mutual constitution with other people.
Is there a process of internalization that takes place whereby the subordinated begin to believe the messages of the higher-ups that they are not, for example, capable of governing themselves?
Absolutely. I mean, that is probably one of the most effective ways in which power is maintained. And although the anarchists said it 150 years ago, we now hear this a lot through the voice of Michel Foucault and his followers, right, who said that one of the most effective ways of power, of exercising power, is to get people who are subordinated to it, in a sense, to police themselves. And that's one of the things that the anarchists talked about. We take in the images of us that society is constantly feeding to us, especially when every institution and practice that we are part of, whether we're thinking about families, which were very hierarchical, the church, which was very hierarchical, schools, every single one of them tells young people, and many of them older people as well, you are incapable. You need our authority in order to exist, and we come to believe that. And that's one of the most difficult things to overcome in any social revolutionary situation. The feminist movement in this country, the civil rights movement in this country, all recognize that. Martin Luther King talked about that feeling of nobodiness, and that one of the things that the civil rights movement was about was trying to, through the experience of solidarity with others, come to a feeling of somebodiness, to know I am somebody, which is a counter to all the messages that are coming from society and then have been internalized by people. And that's the same kind of idea and principle, I think, from which the anarchists were working.
Let's locate some of these anarchist ideas in Spain in the 1800s. Let's go maybe a few decades before the period we're going to focus on, which is the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And back in 1868, you write that anarchism was formally introduced into Spain by an emissary of the great anarchist thinking Mikhail Bakunin. Mm-hmm. His emissary Fanelli arrived in 1868, began to spread the word. To what extent did anarchist ideas find a receptive audience in Spain?
They found a very receptive audience in Spain, I think, because lots of people have looked at this, because there were many traditions in Spain in a variety of different places of collectivism, communalism, some of them based on early millennial movements, some of them supported by earlier, more radical communitarian religious notions within the Catholic Church. So there had been a history going back to even the 13th century in Spain of collective organization, particularly in rural areas. And Fanelli was able to tap into that, I think. And the ideas that he had found, I guess from their point of view, a kind of fertile ground. There were also lots of traditions that had been going on for the 20, 30 years at least before he came, of rural agricultural collectivism. Spain was characterized at this point by southern Spain and the region of Andalusia by massive what were called latifundias, kind of huge agricultural, it's hard to call them farms, but vast landholdings that were mostly owned by absentee landlords, and they were worked by agricultural day laborers who lived in agglomerations of sometimes 10, 15, 20,000 people. So they had also developed traditions of working together. And there were traditions, women in many of these communities had been involved in collective action and continued to be, to try to better the conditions of their family. So there were lots of things that these new ideas they sort of had roots, as it were, already in Spain.
You referred to the experiences many people in Spain had of kind of a collective organization, collective energy. You also refer in this book to urban life in the late 1800s and early 1900s and to working conditions and to the extent to which inequalities existed. And I have a feeling that some of these conditions created a receptive audience among at least some workers in urban centers to anarchist ideas, to the idea of some kind of revolution, to a transformation in what they were going through. What were they experiencing, workers in factories and other workplaces?
Oh, absolutely. The most industrialized area of Spain at the time was Catalonia in the area around Barcelona, and there was also some growing industry in Madrid and in Valencia. But in Catalonia in particular, you had large numbers of people employed in the textile industry, in what we would basically call sweatshops. The conditions of labor were pretty awful, long hours of work, very low wages, no protections. Workers could be thrown out or abused or harassed basically at any time. So you had the beginnings of union organization to try to do something about these conditions. You also had actually, through the late 19th and early 20th century, the Catholic Church was also organizing unions within factories. This was a time of Catholic social teaching, so they were, to some degree, trying to attend to the needs of working people, but I think most of the anarchists felt that they were not going far enough. They were not, church-supported unions were not going far enough, were not challenging the power of employers. So in 1910, the marked the founding of the Confederación Nacional del Trabajo, the National Confederation of Labor, which was the national confederation of anarchist industrial workers. Many, many of those were in textiles, but they were also in other areas. And the anarchist unions, particularly, again, in Catalonia, were very, 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 very strong. There were thousands and thousands of people involved in them.
And the anarchists in these areas, southern Spain and northeastern Spain, many of them kind of align themselves, at least according to your book, with one of two strands of anarchism. One is anarcho-syndicalists, which, let's face it, is just one of, it's a fun word to say. And the other you kind of label as anarchists. And maybe we could start with anarcho-syndicalists and what they envision society, how they envision society.
Well, the anarcho-syndicalists envision society pretty much along the lines of what I was suggesting before, that virtually every workplace would be organized in unions. The Spanish word is sindicato, and the French word is syndicat, which is where the syndicalism comes from. And that society would basically be run by organization of these workplace-based organizations. That it was at the workplace that society was fundamentally structured. And sometimes that's distinguished from... So the anarcho-syndicalist movement, the CNT, which was the main anarchist movement organization in Spain, was structured primarily around workplace-based unions. And then you had another major organization, the FAI, the Federación Anarquista Ibérica, the Anarchist Federation of the Iberian Anarchist Federation, which really tried to, in a sense, spread organization beyond the workplace. And so the kind of alternative mode, which sometimes just gets called anarchist more generally, would have included community-based organizations, things like women's organizations, youth groups, to recognize that there are a variety of different places and contexts in which people could learn to work together and develop these feelings of mutuality that we were talking about, and also develop the capacities that they would need in order to be self-directed, empowered members of a society that they were going to be running together with their, you know, friends and colleagues, as opposed to just sitting back and letting somebody else run it. So the other piece of this, which we didn't talk about, but which I think is very important to understanding the anarchist perspective on social change and on society, is that the way to overcome that internalization of feelings of subordination and disempowerment that we were talking about before, the only way to really overcome that is through action, through direct action, through experiences that allow people to become aware of what their capacities are. And those happened in Spain. One big piece of that was education. They recognized that if people are illiterate, they feel often ignorant. They don't have ways of getting information about the society. So they had many, many programs of literacy and education. And direct action, enabling people to work together with other people to try to make a difference in their community. So they might set up free schools, they set up drama groups, people took action, women in particular took action together to drive down the price of coal or fuel, to drive down the prices of food, to try to control the cost of rent. All of these things, which people, you could say, undertook simply to make their lives better, they understood as having an important dimension of education, empowerment, and developing the capacities that people would need in order to live in a freer society.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. We're speaking with Martha Acklesberg about the lead-up to and eventually the progress of the social revolution affected by anarchists and their allies in many places in Spain in the 1930s, in the midst of the brutal civil war that began there in 1936 and ended in 1939 with the unfortunate victory of the fascist Francisco Franco. So, there's so much to talk about here. We are going to get to the Free Woman of Spain, the Mujeres Libres, but I think one other way of setting up the establishment, the founding of that organization, is to talk about what Spanish anarchism and what Spanish anarchist organizations did in relation to the subordination of women. Did they see it as a problem to be addressed as one element of sort of the structured relations of hierarchy that they wanted eliminated? And what priority did they give to women's liberation?
Yeah, that's a tricky and an important question. One of the things that first attracted me, I have to say, to anarchism in general and Spanish anarchism in particular, is that they did see the subordination of women and hierarchies based on gender as one of the important structured hierarchies that needed to be eliminated if true equality and freedom were to be realized in society. So in a theoretical sense, when they sort of sat back and talked about, you know, what are the ways in which our society is structured hierarchically, gender was one of them. From a pretty early stage, I mean, as early as 1872, in an anarchist congress, they called for equal treatment of men and women at the workplace, for example, which was pretty radical for that day. I mean, we still haven't achieved that in this country in 2006. But although they had this commitment in theory to the emancipation of women and to the equal treatment of women, it often, in terms of union practices, it was often quite secondary, if not tertiary. So as we found in unions and many other places, they tended not to want to bother unionizing women. They tended to see women as more as rate busters. then as potential union members. They saw women as temporary employees. They acted as though attention to gender issues could wait, really, until the revolution was achieved, that other issues were more significant, more important. Now, there were certainly some unions and some male union members who took these gender issues seriously, and we find one of the places where they seemed to be taken most seriously was in some of the more literary, philosophical journals and magazines of the movement that wrote a lot about gender, sexuality, sexual liberation. But in the day-to-day life of most working people and most union organizing, it seems like attention to the subordination of women was pretty secondary.
Martha Ackelsberg joins us today. She is author of Free Women of Spain, Anarchism and the Struggle for the Emancipation of Woman, first published in the early 90s by Indiana University Press. And then there is a new edition just out from AK Press with a new preface by the author. She teaches government and women's studies at Smith College. We'll take a short break and be back to talk more about Spanish Revolution and women with Martha Ackelsberg. Please stay with us.